So this is going to be a doubleheader. Those of you that are American know what that means. I had a little discussion about what to have a discussion about. And we're going to have something that's both for the adults and for the kids, and then the second part is for the kids and the adults. Hope it'll work out. The first part is a summary of chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita, the most confidential knowledge. And you'll hear chapter 9 three times in the course of this evening. I'll summarize it, we'll hear it narrated and see it pictured, and I'll also summarize it as we're going along. So you'll have a nice idea of Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, the most confidential knowledge. And then we'll take a deep breath and we'll have all the kids sit in the front, and they're going to be the students of the evening. And I'll give them questions before the exam, and then we'll hear and see at the Shamantaka jewel story, and then we'll review it and have them answer all the questions, whatever questions they can't answer, then the big kids here can answer. That's the evening. Then we'll see what happens after that. So, how many chapters are there in Bhagavad Gita?
18.
What's 18 divided by 2? 9. So, right in the midway in Bhagavad Gita is chapter 9. Very good. So, chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita is called the most confidential knowledge. What's most confidential about most confidential knowledge? We gave this morning some explanation of that most confidential, more confidential, most confidential, given by Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur and Srila Prabhupada, the kind of knowledge that the sages who were visiting, the Bhaktivedantas who were visiting at the inn where Narada in his previous life and his mother were serving, and they instructed the most confidential part of knowledge. So we're going to give now a little different approach, but it ends up in the same place. It's another way of saying the same thing. In common language, confidential means, don't tell anybody, I have something very confidential to say. That kind of confidential. But this is another kind of confidential. This is something you can tell it to everybody and still they don't get it. It's that kind of confidential. Because it's confidential, because it's directly relates to the self, who we really are. And you can explain to somebody who they really are, and it's psst, 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 psst. And get it. But that's confidential knowledge. Knowledge of the soul. Chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. And then, more confidential. Some people, theoretically at least, get it. I'm spirit soul. But more confidential is what? Different than the individual soul is the supreme soul. Because some people think, I'm spirit soul and I am Brahman and everything is Brahman and that's all there is Brahman, so I'm God. And there's another, more confidential knowledge that says, there's a supreme soul, that's distinct from the individual soul. The individual soul is part of the Supreme Soul, but the Supreme Soul is chapter 13, Bhagavad Gita. Chetragya and Chetragya Chapi Mam Vidhi Sarva Kshetreshu Bharata. There's one soul that's conscious of all fields of activity. That's not us. We're imperfectly conscious of this field of activity. We're not conscious of the pains and pleasures and the field of activity of all living entities. We can't even think of all living entities. What to speak of, be conscious of the field of activities of all living entities. So there's two. It's more confidential. And most confidential is the relationship between the individual soul and the Supreme Soul in their fully manifested state of loving exchange with one another. That's most confidential. And then there's the most confidential part of the most confidential knowledge. Prabhupada describes it that way. The last verse of the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is the one verse that appears twice in Bhagavad Gita, or almost the same presentation of it. What's that last verse in the ninth chapter? Manmana bhavamad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru mami vaishasi satyam te pratijani priyosi me. Krishna's describing Priya, how that person becomes most dear to him. And we're going to hear some more of that also in the chapter. So that's the subject. What's the most confidential part? And the most confidential part is bhakti, because it's devotion that connects the living entity to the Supreme in the most confidential way. Only through bhakti can one understand Krishna. There's a trade-off with everything in the material world. Okay. So, also from our acharyas, there are three main topics in the Bhagavad Gita. Baladeva Vidyabhusan says there's five. That's another way of analyzing it. But another way of analyzing it is there's three. Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. And of those three, the most important is Bhakti Yoga. And Bhakti Yoga goes in the middle of Bhagavad Gita. So let's look at the Mahabharata. Mahabharata is maha, big. And within that big Mahabharata is right in the middle, almost in the middle, is Bhagavad Gita. And within Bhagavad Gita there's Karma Yoga. The first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita largely deal with non-fruitive work. It has other things, but that which is essential to non-fruitive work, karma, phala, tyag. And the final six chapters are largely repeating things that have already been said in a deeper elucidation of knowledge, gyan, yoga. Yoganis really like chapter 13. Because it's romper room. They can go all over the place with chapter 13. Sankhya. And then in the middle is bhakti. Why is bhakti in the middle? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives three reasons why bhakti is in the middle. One of those reasons he gives is it's because it's most important. When you have a parade, a procession, who goes in the middle? If there's, the president or the governor or some, it's that kind of dignitary. Does he go at the front of the parade, the middle of the parade, or the end of the parade? Middle of the parade. I can give some details, but that's the standard all over the world, go in the middle. So a simile, bhakti is in the middle. Then another example he gives is with a house. What's the most essential part of the house? The main support beam or the walls and windows or the plumbing electricity? The main support beam, because without the main support beam, those other things are useless. A whole stack of walls and a whole stack of plumbing and a whole stack of electrical things, and it's nothing without the main support beam. And the main support beam holds up everything else. So it goes in the middle. You don't put the main support beam out in the backyard or, you know, on the left side of the house. You put it right in the middle of the house. Right in the middle. And the third example he gives is, supposing you have in your family some heirlooms, something handed down through generations that's extremely valuable. Where do you put those valuables? At the main gate. Here we don't have gates, but in India there's gates, and you put it out at the gate. You put it in your backyard, you put it somewhere securely in the center of the house. Because bhakti is the most valuable, it goes right in the middle. It gives support to the others, and it's the essence of the whole message of Bhagavad Gita. So that's what we're going to be discussing this evening. It's a build-up for this important topic. And therefore it's given this title, Paramaguhyam. So I'll give a quick overview of the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. In the PowerPoint presentation, it's going to show three sections, but those sections have further subsections. And the first is Mahima. What's the glories of this most confidential knowledge? Rajavidya, Rajaguhyam, Pavitram, Idam Uttamam, Pratyaksha, Avagamam Dharmyam, Susukam, Kartamavyayam. Yeah, so it's very special. And it's so special that there's a lot of people that don't understand it because they don't have the qualification, and the qualification to understand it is... What was that? You're not sure. Faith. Yeah, faith. Faith. Yes, faith. And Krishna adds another important ingredient. They're not envious. Are any anasuyas here? Okay. Non-envious of Krishna. And then Krishna indicates what happens to those who are envious. They have a hard time. Not only in understanding Krishna, they have a hard time in life. Because this knowledge can bring one to the position of real happiness, and minus that real happiness, it's unhappiness. And it's an unfortunate situation. So then Krishna describes there are persons who, they're faithless. And so they essentially they rot in the material world. Then those that are faithful and they can understand Krishna. Then Krishna gets very liberal. He becomes inclusive first, and then he becomes exclusive. He includes as his devotees Ekatvena, Pratakdvena, Bahudavishvatomukam. Those who are worshippers of the universal form. Those who are worshippers of demigods. Those who are worshipping themselves. Ekatvena, it's called something puja. Like Krishna. When Krishna, we read in Krishna book, or 10th canto Bhagavatam, when he's in Dwaraka and the roosters crow in the morning, that's the alarm clock system, the roosters crow, even in Dwaraka they had roosters. They were vegetarian, but they had roosters. And the roosters crow and Krishna would wake up, and much to the chagrin of the queens, Krishna would get up and do his morning sadhana. And what was his morning sadhana? He would meditate on Krishna. So he meditated upon himself. Prabhupada once described there was some yogi on stage and he was showing this ahangra upasana, that's what the term is. They worshiped themselves. He sat on the stage and worshiped himself and became God by worshiping himself. So ekat vena, Krishna is very liberal. Even those. And bahuda vishvata mukham ekat vena pratakt vena bahuda. Bahuda. Bahu means many. They worship the many. They worship the demigods. And they worship the universal form. Of those, Prabhupada explains, the worshipper of the universal form is best. Because going the other... Anyway, Krishna is very broad. They are also my devotees. But then there are those that understand that Krishna has a personal form because they're not envious. And Krishna discloses it to them. And so... They worship him with love. They worship him with whatever it is that they do, an offer and give away, whatever else. They worship him in various ways. They offer him with love and devotion, various things of life, fruit and flower, leaf and water. By doing that, they become free from the reactions of their past involvement with matter. And they achieve the highest result. And then Krishna describes that he, while he's neutral, it looks like he's partial. So this is a very delicate, because we don't want to fault Krishna, because he's faultless. But it looked like he's partial. And Prabhupada explains that partiality is not partiality, it's according to the disposition of the devotee. Because they love Krishna, they approach Krishna with love. And Krishna responds with love. He's just responding as they approach to him. Yayatam mam prapadyante. Those that approach him inimically, Krishna reciprocates in kind. He's not inimical to them, but he's reciprocating with their regard for him, that's all. It's not, oh, you don't like me, I'm going to get you. Not like that at all. He's just reciprocating. He's neutral. So it appears that he's partial to his devotees because they love him. But Krishna shows that reciprocation to his devotees. And sometimes even those very elevated devotees, they slip, or they become influenced by an overwhelming surge of the material energy, and they make some mistake, or some bad mistake, or some very bad mistake. Krishna explains, I consider that person who's the Ananya Bhak, or Ananya Bhakta, to be saintly. That means we should consider them saintly. And he personally, Krishna personally, steps in, corrects the situation, and restores them to their proper saintly behavior. That's Krishna's kindness. And all of this will go back to the beginning of the chapter, this confidential knowledge is, hang on, we're going to do the pictures in just a minute. He's getting restless. Hang on, we're going to go to what kids can appreciate in just a minute. This is the adult's part, and then comes the kid's part. Hang on. In chapter 8, Krishna is described, what's the chapter 8, attaining the supreme? So Krishna describes the ways by which the yogi can attain the supreme when the sun is moving into the northerly direction and so on and so on and so on. So many conditions. But Krishna says, for one who is my ananya bhakta, they don't have to concern themselves with these things. At any time they leave their body, they're attaining that which their mind is fixed upon, which is Krishna. So now he's describing how that ananya bhakti, or the ananya bhakta, achieves the state that they attain. Through unmixed devotion. So he's described mixed devotion and unmixed devotion. And he's advocating unmixed devotion for his devotee. And how does one do that? Manmana bhavamad bhakto. Since it's so important to have your mind fixed upon Krishna, then he brings in chapter 10. Arjuna asks, how can I always think of you? And Krishna answers, here's how you can always think of me. So maybe next time I visit, we'll cover chapter 10, how to always think of Krishna. Here's chapter 9. You got the light on the projector?
Chapter 9, The Most Confidential Knowledge.
I have a slide change. Oh. So the way this is set up is, it's just three parts. But the king of knowledge, the introduction or the glories of chapter 9 are described right at the very beginning.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed."
So, these are wonderful glories. To have direct perception, pratyaksha, means to directly see, aksha means eyes, pratyaksha, directly, just like we're directly seeing one another, to directly see the soul. You can't see the soul with material vision, it's too small. It's smaller than an atom. But you can see through spiritual vision, to see, not just theoretically understand. Pratyaksha is not theoretical understanding, it's spiritual seeing. Now there's a condition. That's the glories.
"Those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore they return to the path of birth and death in this material world."
So one might ask the question, we're going to ask the question, if this is so nice, so beneficial, why don't we find everybody doing it? That's a natural question. And what's the answer? Because they have no faith. What's the nature of why it is that people don't have faith? One answer is, some people just don't know. Your head's right in the way. Because they don't know, any better, they're ignorant, they're faithless. Sometimes they know, but they don't believe. That's another problem. Sometimes they just have this nature of being always hesitant and doubting about everything. They can't place their faith in tying their shoelaces properly. That's their nature, but to speak of God. Krishna repeats the message again and again, and still they can't accept the supreme position of bhakti. They think it's just some empty praise, some exaggeration. And it's certainly unscientific, sentimental, and only good for uneducated people. And there are people that think like that, only weak-minded, blah, 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 blah. When it's actually just the opposite. One has to be very strong-minded to become, to fight the current of materialism in society. Some people, they're just not interested. They're too much absorbed in sense gratification, and so they have no faith. Okay, you guys know the Dr. Frog story? Yes? Would you like to tell us the Dr. Frog story? You don't remember it. Okay, I'll help you. You know the Dr. Frog story? Once upon a time, there was a Dr. Frog. And he was living in the bottom of a well. There's water at the bottom of the well. And someone came to visit Dr. Frog and said, "My dear Dr. Frog, I've been to the Atlantic Ocean and its huge body of water." And Dr. Frog said, "Really? How big? Twice as big as this well?" No, much bigger, much bigger." "Three times as big? Five times as big?" No, it's much bigger, you can't imagine." So the Dr. Frogs of this world, that's the scientist. Notice he's got his scientist uniform on, with his little spectacles, can only imagine something that's from within their own experience, but they can't imagine something that's beyond their experience, even though it exists, because they've never experienced it, they can't even imagine it. They try to compare it to what they know. And so, understanding what to speak of God, even understanding the soul, they remain faithless. No. Something so small and so powerful, it can power an elephant. It's smaller than an atom. So, what is this thing that's faith? It's so important to understand this ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, to understand Krishna. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught that faith means unflinching trust in something sublime. And that something sublime is so great that just by this one thing, all other things desirable can be accomplished. That's faith. One thing. So I could just be focused on one thing. Somehow, one thing, achieve that one thing, just like a materialist. What's their faith largely? Money. Get money. Because money's the honey. So get that money. Money, money, money. Because when I have money, I can get all the things I want. All the things that are important in life. Through money. You get money. Or somebody else is, the Olympic athlete has faith, I gotta get that gold medal. Everything follows behind that one thing. Or the scholar or the whatever it is, someone that really wants to achieve something in this world. They invest so much in that one thing. Our understanding of faith in terms of devotion is that if we can find the root of all existence and place everything on the root of all existence, the whole tree of existence is nourished, just like putting water on the root of a tree. Everything desirable that comes from the tree is taken care of. Therefore, faith is the most important factor for progressing the spiritual life. So that leads to the next question. How do you get it? Go to Walmart's and get it, right? No. Maybe Whole Foods. Where do you get faith? From those that have faith, right? So, when you find, like, this is the prostitute who's shaved her head and is now chanting the holy name, Haridas Thakur. She was, through the association of Haridas Thakur, had faith. She now has faith in the holy name. So much so that any other thing was simply a distraction and she completely gave it up. So progressing in faith means that also. Practically, faith, growing in faith means those things that take one away from the faithful position are given up. Don't do that, boys. Thank you. And whatever reluctance there is, that should be cast aside. Because if we don't have faith in Krishna, there's a whole chapter on this, divisions of faith. You're going to have faith in something else according to the modes of nature. Like, get that money, or win that, whatever that is, cup. Or build your body and become, you know, muscle man, or something. Faith in something. Because faith is intrinsic to the soul. So we get faith through association of devotees. Here's Narada giving his association to a king. This is King Prachinibari, who was a mixed devotee, but he became a pure devotee through Narada's association. And when we're in the association of those saintly persons, we hear from them respectfully, just like Shukadev Goswami heard. Excuse me, Maharaj Parikshit heard from Shukadev Goswami. And they're nice painting. Srila Prabhupada speaking the message of Bhagavad Gita to persons who faithfully heard from him. And by hearing from Srila Prabhupada, they became fixed in devotion. And also by serving. Who is pictured in this painting? Who? Good, that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Who's that? King Prataparudra. That was the king. In that place in Puri, the king of all the land, Orissa and even further down to Tamil Nadu, and further down, and further up. He was a huge, popular, wonderful king, but he got the favor of Mahaprabhu by serving very humbly Lord Jagannath. He swept the road before Lord Jagannath at the Rath Yatra procession. So a prime example of one who became fixed in devotion through association and hearing, Narada Muni. So we'll do a little review of the Narada Muni story. Narada Muni had a very good memory. Narada Muni can not just, like if I asked you, kids, what were you doing at 5:35 yesterday? You'd have to like scratch your head and pull your chin and try to figure it out. What was I doing at 5:30 yesterday? But Narada was remembering his previous life, what he was doing. And his previous life was in a previous day of Brahma. And do you know how long is the day of Brahma? It's a lot of years. 4,320,000,000 years. That's a lot of zeros. A lot of years. But he was remembering his previous life. He was the son of a maidservant. There she is. And visiting at the inn, Prabhupada uses that word, Dharamshala, where the sages were staying for the 4 months of the rainy season. They were very elevated Vedantists. They were Bhakti Vedantists. And when they were staying at the inn, little Naradaji, he had the opportunity to serve them. He brought them their meals, he would wash their clothes, little errands here and there, and whatever they wanted, he had the opportunity to serve them in a personal way. And as he was serving them, he also heard their discussions, and he was very attracted to their discussions. And Narada described that he was very gentle by nature, and he wasn't frivolous. I know some of you are like this. He didn't talk too much, just, you know, very calm, very peaceful. And they were appreciating his qualities, and so they showed their special mercy upon him. Although he was just very small, just a little boy, they were especially, it was natural also, they were especially kind upon this nice little boy. So one time, with their permission, he took the remnants of their food. We have this term, prasad and maha prasad and maha maha prasad. That was the kind he got, maha maha prasad. And he liked it. And he felt something. He felt purified by taking that maha maha prasad. And through that hearing and serving and associating and taking the prasad of the Vaishnavas, their whole way of life became very attractive to him, and slowly his material attractions diminished, his attraction for the personality of Godhead increased more and more, and as his taste for hearing their topics grew, he had this realization that his real identity was altogether different than the gross and subtle coverings, the body and the mind, and that he and the Lord were transcendental. It wasn't theoretical. He had that realization. And this most confidential knowledge was imparted to him, like we were discussing this morning. And he could then understand the energies of the Lord, Krishna himself, the maintainer, creator, and annihilator of everything. And that just by following this method that the Bhakti Vedantas gave him, he would go to Krishna. He was a small boy, but he had that faith. Then after some time, they left that place. And one evening, when his mother went to get water from the well, she was bitten on the leg by a serpent and instantly died. Now here, this little boy, his mother's dead. He didn't even know where his father was. And most children, imagine, you know, 6 years old, some of you look about that age. What do you do? What do you do? But he had such faith in Krishna that he took it as an arrangement of Krishna somehow. And remembering what the Bhakti Vedantas had taught him, he left that place at once and began traveling like a traveling mendicant. And as he was traveling here and there, he experienced all varieties of life. He passed through cities. They had cities then also. Probably looked a little different than they look now. Towns and villages. And deep, dark in the forest. He traveled all the different places. And each day, he would do that process of meditation that they gave him, the chanting of his sacred mantra, and fix his mind in the meditation process. One day, under a large banyan tree in an uninhabited part of the forest, he did what he did every day. He sat down, did his process of meditation. And what happened? As soon as he began to meditate upon the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, instantly Krishna appeared in the lotus of his heart. And he was experiencing bhava, trembling of the body and tears streaming from his eyes. He was in ecstatic devotion. And then what happened? Suddenly, the Lord disappeared. And so he opened his eyes from meditation, he looked in all directions, and he didn't see the Lord, and he was smashed. Oh, the Lord is gone. And then he heard a voice rumbling as deep as thunder. And the Lord said, I've shown myself to you out of special compassion, because ordinarily I'm only seen by perfected souls, but because of your sincerity, I've shown myself to you. Now please continue for the balance of your lifetime just as you are doing, and at the end of your life you will come to me. You will achieve spiritual perfection. Imagine hearing that voice. So that's what Narada did. He lived the balance of his life, and when that time came for death, he describes that the soul left the body and at once assumed a spiritual form. And according to the Lord's plan, the Lord had some service for him. So along with all the other souls and all matter, they were drawn within the body of Garbhadakshay Vishnu at the time of the night of Brahma, and then again at the end of the night of Brahma, the next day of Brahma, all those beings came out and he became the son of Lord Brahma. And since that time, he's been Narada Muni, playing upon his transcendental veena. It's not an ordinary musical instrument like the one you hear in the background here. Sitar. He just played that veena and sang names of Krishna, and he could travel anywhere. No ticket, no visa, no passport, no jet fuel. Just take off and go wherever he wanted to go. In this world, in the heavenly realm, even in the spiritual realm, he could go straight to visit Krishna in Dwarka. He had no restriction, completely unrestricted. But he has only one interest in using that facility, giving faith into the hearts of those that are suitable recipients. And so, by the association of Narada-like personalities, one can develop faith and understand this ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita.
Krishna's unmanifested form pervades everything, but Krishna himself remains detached from matter. Material nature, working under his direction, produces all moving and non-moving beings.
So in order to understand Krishna, you have to understand Krishna's energy. So he describes the relationship between his energy and himself. And it's mystical. It's this, what I call Upanishadic double talk. Like you've studied, many of you have studied Sri Isha Upanishad because Prabhupada translated it. And there's some of that Upanishadic double talk. He walks and he does not walk. He's very near and he's very far away as well. He's within everything and he's outside of everything. What's that? How do you understand that? Well, if you're an impersonalist, you go one direction. If you're a devotee, you go another direction. And this ninth chapter is, he's already said it. It can be understood by devotees who have faith in him. And the others aren't going to understand. They'll, if they think they understand, they've got a wrong understanding. They'll understand something else. The relationship between Krishna and his energies, Mahaprabhu's teaching is, They're inconceivably one and different. So Krishna can be inside of everything, and everything is within him. It's like saying, you know, we're within the room, and the room is within us. Well, that's not so. But for Krishna, it's so. Or we can be in the room or out of the room, but we can't be both in the room and out of the room. But Krishna can be both in the room and out of the room, because he has inconceivable potencies. He has a non-different relationship between himself and his potencies.
By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence.
Okay, so what does it mean? Everything rests on Krishna. Well, it's not the Greek mythology Atlas that he's just like, have any of you been at Rockefeller Center in New York City? There's a statue of Atlas. There he is, holding up the world. Big biceps and strong guy, looking very tired, holding up everything. Not that kind of. But by his potencies, Krishna is doing, because he's aloof from the creation, although it's acting under his direction, he does nothing at all. It's like remote control. Remote control. I was visiting our devotees in Chicago once, Sundown. And they live in this housing development. Some of you have been there in Palatine. And so there were some kids that were playing this little toy. And there was a little boy walking along the street, and he saw this car going zoom, zoom, zoom. And all of a sudden, little toy car. Then the little toy car went zoom, zoom, 90 degree different angle. Then it backed up. Zoom, zoom, zoom. Then turned around the other direction. And the little boy was wondering what's going on. He was watching this thing. And then there's another little boy laughing and laughing because he had his remote control gadget. Then his father came down and told the little boy, see over there? There's this remote control gadget. And he's making the little toy car move with remote control. So Krishna doesn't even need a little gadget. Everything is working under remote control. But it takes is Krishna's just willing. And it's zoom, zoom, zoom. Or reverse, or whatever it is. Or his sanction. Krishna is so powerful that although everything is connected to him, it's going on by his acknowledgement, and inconceivable potencies make everything happen. So in this way, Krishna is different from this material manifestation, and yet he's also present personally. He exists in his own abode, but he's personally present through his feature of Paramatma. This is one of Rabindra Swarup Prabhu's favorite topics. There's nothing but Krishna, and Krishna is outside of everything. Anyway. Okay. Sound?
All living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation. For myself is the very source of creation. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature. And at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again. And under my will, it is annihilated at the end. O Dhananjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all these material activities, seated as though neutral. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O Son of Kunti. Producing all moving and non-moving beings.
Foolish persons do not know Krishna's transcendental and supreme nature. They consider the human-like form of the Lord to be material. The great souls, however, are undiluted.
So this previous section was Krishna and his energies, and it's difficult to understand. It's a mystical way in which Krishna works with his energies. And he just described that although he does this and does that, actually he does nothing. Another double talk. Because it's going on through his energies. Now what about Krishna himself? Well, what to speak of not understanding Krishna's energies? Those same faithless persons don't understand Krishna's form either. So now we're going to hear Krishna describe how those who are foolish and faithless regard his form, and then those that are faithful regard his form.
Fools deride me when I descend in the human form. I do not know my transcendental nature as the supreme lord of all that be. Those who are thus bewildered are attracted by demonic and atheistic views. In that deluded condition, their hopes for liberation, their fruitive activities, and their culture of knowledge are all defeated. Son of Pritha, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the supreme personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. Always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination bowing down before me. These great souls perpetually worship me with devotion.
So Krishna then is describing the topmost position, unmixed devotion, because we've heard mixed devotion. Now he's going to describe in this very broad way different types of how different persons view him, those who are thinking of themselves as devotees. So this is the second section, the object of worship.
Others who engage in sacrifice by the cultivation of knowledge worship the Supreme Lord as the one without a second, as diverse in many, and in the universal form. But it is I who am the ritual, me the sacrifice, the offering to the ancestors, the healing herb. The transcendental charm. I am the butter and the fire and the offering. I am the father of this universe. The mother, the support and the grandsire. I am the object of knowledge. The purifier and the syllable Om. I am also the Rig, the Sama and the Yajur Vedas. I am the goal. The sustainer, the master, the witness. The abode, the refuge. And the most dear friend. I am the creation and the annihilation, the basis of everything, the resting place, and the eternal seed. O Arjuna, I give heat, and I withhold and send forth the rain. I am immortality, and I am also death personified. Both spirit and matter are in me.
Different worshippers reach different goals. Men who want to attain the heavenly planets worship the demigods, and then take birth among them to enjoy godly delights. But such men, after exhausting their pious credits, return to earth. Men who worship ancestors go to the planets of the ancestors, and those who worship ghosts become ghosts. The one who worships Krishna with exclusive devotion goes to him forever.
Another important message in chapter 9 is worship is natural because it's a natural disposition of the soul as faith is, but according to the different objects, there are different destinations for the different categories of worshippers.
Those who study the Vedas and drink the Soma juice, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planet of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights. When they have thus enjoyed vast heavenly sense pleasure and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they return to this mortal planet again. Thus, those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. But those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack. And I preserve what they have. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith, actually worship only me, O son of Kunti. But they do so in a wrong way.
That's aviti purvakam. The intention can be right or good, but without proper understanding, one may undergo the process of trying to water the leaves and the branches. And that's what demigod worship is like, instead of watering the root of the tree. So Krishna has described this as, it's intended for me alone, but without that vidhi, without that knowledge, Then it's misdirected.
I am the only enjoyer and master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me.
Okay, home stretch. We're almost done. So now, this is very, very confidential. That is, what Krishna feels when those persons approach him with pure devotion. What does Krishna feel? And what does he do?
Whatever Krishna's devotee does, eats, offers, or gives away in charity, he does as an offering unto the Lord. Krishna reciprocates by carrying what his devotee lacks and preserving what he has. By taking shelter of Krishna, even low-born persons can attain the supreme destination.
If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept it. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. In this way, you will be freed from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me, in this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him. Even if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination. He quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. O son of Pritha, those who take shelter in me, though they be of lower birth, women, Vaishyas, merchants, and Sudras, workers, can attain the supreme destination. How much more this is so with the righteous Brahmanas, the devotees, and the saintly kings. Therefore, having come to this temporary, miserable world, engage in loving service unto me. Engage your mind, always thinking of me. Become my devotee. Offer obeisances to me. And worship me. Being completely absorbed in me, surely you will come to me.
the end of chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita. So, I think I've warned the kids out, but this is kids' show is next. Oh man, I gotta stick around. Well, let's see what you can do. So this is part two of the double header. If you have questions from this one, you can remember them. And now it's the Shamantaka Jewel story. What we're going to do is, what I'd like to do is, try again to have the kids sit, I guess it's too much to ask. I'm gonna ask questions after this. Don't think they're, I lost my audience there. We should have done it the other way around, the kids part first. We'll have to remember that next time, kids part first. Okay. Maybe I just skip it. And save it for when the kids aren't restless. What should I do? Take a break, have a kirtan, and then have the kids come back? Too much to sit for all that time. Okay. So, let's see, it's 7 o'clock. Kids, if you need to get up and, like, you know, do something else for a while, go ahead. Come back at 7:30. At 7:30, we're going to have kids hour. Okay. Harry Ball. Come back at 7:30, don't forget. You'll like it. We'll see. Okay, so any discussion from the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Yes.
Maharaj, is there a, or is there difference? What is the difference between uninstalled deity worship and installed deity worship at home?
Okay. Would you like a soft answer or a hard answer? Which one would you like first? Soft one? Okay. Okay, we'll do soft, hard, and go back to soft. Okay. Krishna is Krishna. So, the form of Krishna is Krishna. So, if you have deities in your home that have not been in prana pratishtha installed, it's still worshipable form of Krishna. Just have pictures. It's Krishna. I'll tell you a Prabhupada story. One of the early artists whose name was Muralidhar. Muralidhar was a fantastic artist. I mean, award-winning paintings. Fantastic artist. Being very sincere and gentle, he wanted to hear from Prabhupada what Krishna looked like, so that he could paint Krishna properly. So he, one time when Prabhupada was visiting, he got a whole bunch of different paintings of Krishna and asked Prabhupada which one looks most like Krishna. Right? Good question for an artist to ask. And Prabhupada dismissed the question, saying they're all Krishna. So he thought maybe he didn't understand, so he waited till, you know, later in the discussion, he asked the same question. He got the same answer. So he said, well, what about a child's little stick drawing of Krishna? And Prabhupada said, And he showed one. He said, there is Krishna's peacock feather. There is Krishna's flute. Krishna standing in his threefold bending form. There are the cows. There's the river Jamuna. That's Krishna. That's what Prabhupada told him. And he's the artist that's got to paint Krishna. So paintings of Krishna are, according to Nectar of Devotion, there are seven mediums in which Krishna can be worshipped. In stone, wood, metal, paint, jewels, in the mind. I forget what the seventh one is. So that's Krishna. So that's the soft answer. When you're worshipping deities of Krishna in your home, or Gornatai in your home, whatever deity you have in your home, that's Krishna. Now, a hard answer is, this is from our deity worship ministry. There's no such thing as uninstalled deities. It's a doll. Deity means installed. That's like the hard answer. Practice. Like you might give your children a doll. Prabhupada described like that. His father was worshipping deities. Daddy, I can have, so he gave him dolls. They were deities. But Prabhupada himself said dolls. Because uninstalled is not, because with installed means pran pratishta, you're inviting Krishna to come and receive your worship. And it's very, very specific. It's part of deity worship, pran pratishta. That's the hard answer. Practice. Then someday, take Brahminical initiation and worship the deities in the temple, or install deities in your home. I know some devotees that they worship deities in their home on the same level as worship in the temple. Because home standard is less than temple standard, because they're pran pratishta installed deities. Because, you know, there's a very strict, scripturally based standard of what minimally must be done. Maximally, it just keeps going, but, so. Now back to the soft answer. You should worship in your home, worship your deities as if they were installed. Or, you know, you worship with seriousness. Otherwise, you know, you don't need deities, you just have pictures. But you invite deities into your home, worship should be done in a serious way. So uninstalled means pran pratishta hasn't been performed. Installed means pran pratishta has been performed. And the standards are very strict. Now, anything after that is detail, like, well, should I do this or should I not do this? And become qualified. That's it. I pressed into the next level with Gaura Keshava. He's like amongst all the deity worshippers and authorities in deity worship. They regard him as a, you know, very strong authority in matter of deity worship. So if somebody has deities in their home, they should become Brahminical initiated and worship them in a serious way. That's the hard answer. But lots of people are worshiping deities that aren't Brahminically initiated, and they're not installed. So in one sense, it's practice. But when one wants to consider, this is not just practice, this is I'm making offerings to my deity. Krishna is accepting and Krishna is reciprocating. And Krishna does. One worships with love and devotion. You get the idea? Anything else?
What are you saying? There's a difference between the temple prana pratishtha and home prana pratishtha? Like, as far as what you're supposed to do?
Oh. No. Prana pratishtha doesn't matter home or temple. Prana pratishtha is a formal ceremony according to Vedic standards, and prana pratishtha is prana pratishtha, wherever the location may be. Very few families undertake that process of prana pratishtha when they're worshipping in their home. They may worship with very, you know, in a very serious manner with very serious standards. But that's not saying that makes, that constitutes prana pratishtha. It's a formal, detailed, elaborate ceremony. Look at the videos of the prana pratishtha of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Panchatattva, or Krishna Balaram. Days. It's very elaborate. Anything else? Yes?
This is a follow-up question. I was thinking if you have pictures or unsolved deities in your home, you make an offering.
Yes. Krishna accepts. That's the first answer. Krishna is there. Krishna accepts. Yes.
So, and let's say you have installed deities, but you're not offering the devotion. Then
Krishna doesn't have to accept anything.
So, I'm trying to understand that if you're saying that Krishna can be worshipped in pains.
Yeah. I just repeated what Rupa Goswami said, so I can take credit for having said it, but I'm just repeating Rupa Goswami. Krishna can be presented to us in the worshipable form of those seven items, including in the mind. That's one of them. Like the Brahmana who did his Manasa Puja. Right? You know that description. No, the individual should take permission from their spiritual authority before doing such a thing. It's with blessings. And then specifically also when approaching the deity, one doesn't just approach the deity. It's in the procedure of deity worship, one offers prayers, essentially taking permission from the spiritual master to approach the deity, because it's understood one is doing so on behalf of the spiritual master. So certainly anybody can go to a Murtiwala shop in Vrindavan and buy some deities. But the instruction, for those who are following Archana Vidhi, you take permission. And then when worshipping, you take permission each time you approach the deity. It's, you know, directly in the protocol, you know, the vittis for archana. Is that all right?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Well, I had a question about those who worship ancestors go to the ancestors' planet, it was told.
Yeah.
So,
where's that?
Because I had a hard time understanding that, because based on each one's karma, like, you know, they go different routes. So what is this? Ancestors.
Well, karma is something that's very complicated. You know, trace out the karmic cause of some event. Very complicated. Krishna says it right in Bhagavad Gita. It's a very difficult topic to understand. So, the destination that one goes to is not only karma, it's also, you know, guna and karma. And where the mind is fixed is going to be determined by guna and karma. So where the mind is fixed, one will go there. Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam jatatante kalevaram. That's the standard that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Where you'll go after this life is where the mind is fixed at the time of death. Jajadante. Kalevaram. So ancestor worship is not just an Vedic thing. It's, you know, it's a very prominent Asian thing. You aware of that? Like, you know, Oriental people, Chinese people, or all types. They worship their ancestors. They don't have a concept of God. They worship their ancestors. So there's such a place where one can go. Be with your ancestors. And there's a way of releasing souls from that place by proper Vedic procedure. Shraddha. They can move on. So there's, you know, it's very intricate. Just as it's not that if you, you know, do some worship one time to Krishna that you go to Krishna Loka, that you make some offering to your ancestors sometime, you go to the Pitra Loka. It's, you know, it's where the mind is fixed. That's part of how one fixes the mind. And on a regular basis, one fixes the mind. And one who has such an aspiration can achieve it. Yes.
Maharaj, when we are going through this anartha nivritti process, one thing is what's moving us forward is our sincerity and our determination. And what's holding us back is our previous conditioning. That's kind of pushing us back, but we are trying to move forward with our sincerity and determination. And if we are feeling that I'm making little progress or no progress, kind of that kind of state, how does one know that, I have to be patient, conditioning is too much, let me be patient and just practice devotional service. Or one can think, no, my sincerity and determination is less, so I should put more effort, more and more effort. So, you know, there is some lacking in effort department, I should put more effort. Or one should be patient and think that, no, it's conditioning, it's strong conditioning, it'll go away with some time. What's the guideline about it?
The way that you described your question is almost like, you know, a mathematical equation or something. You know, in the law of physics, how much stress can we put on something before it snaps? If I could step back from the framework of your question and just frame it differently and say that we have a relationship with Krishna. And to some degree, we want that relationship, and to some other degree, we don't. We have, you know, we're habituated to our conditionings, as you put it. We should strive, like this question this morning about reading Prabhupada's books. circumstantially it's difficult. Habitually, it's, you know, I'm not inclined. So, you know, I do other things instead. Although I know I should read Prabhupada's books. So it's do something that's doable because I understand it's good for me even I'm not inclined. Yes, you know, the conditioning is pushing against me. But there's this deeper sense that happiness will really come if I can get on the other side of this conditioning. So you do something that's, you make some effort with devotion. And the devotion goes towards the relationship with Krishna. And then there's this you continue to go, you know, in steps and in increments towards the goal, the relationship with Krishna, and just keep moving towards that relationship. Knowing that it's real. We had, a common comparison is if you're in darkness, and you see in the distance a light, just keep moving towards the light and you'll get there. This past weekend, a group of us were together in Seattle, and the plan was to have a patrons leader weekend, and they had us go to this place which right by the border of Canada and Washington, U.S. So on the other side of the canal, you can see Vancouver Island, and then there's this thing they call a spit. I mean, it's S-P-I-T. It's just a little tract of land that's 5 miles long, and at the end there's a lighthouse. So we walked it 5 miles. It's just this little narrow thing. I mean, not a little wider, but and a whole group of us went to the end of that. So you just keep walking and knowing eventually you get there. There it is. It's far away. And you can't go left or right. You have to keep. So if it was dark, you may not even be able to see where the land is in the middle of the ocean. But it's there. Just keep walking and get to the lighthouse. And there were 3 guys there. So in Krishna Loka, there's more than 3 guys. There's Krishna and his whole spiritual realm. And the process of bhakti is to take us there. It's the relationship. So in a relationship, you know, Krishna, we're not going to break Krishna, we're not going to break ourselves either. But we should go in a sustainable way toward Krishna. I'm framing your question in a different way, but just, you know, we have our limitations, we have our conditioning, we have our desires to reach Krishna. Keep investing in the relationship with Krishna, knowing we don't want to, you know, push ourselves artificially too far so it's just like the conditioning pushes back so hard, you know, we're flat. Okay, here come the kids again. Well, not really. I can feel the vibration. It's like we don't want to be here. I think we'll do this. We're going to do this other thing another time when it's fresh. Okay, Gokul Chandra? The thing with the kids is going to be another time. Just doesn't, the mood's not right.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
So I heard that Prabhupada did say householders should definitely worship deities. So should everyone have their own?
Well, you know, how many people want to go live near the Detroit Temple and send their kids to school in that district? Not too many. So home worship. But like, you know, in Los Angeles, Prabhupada was not very pleased that so many householders had their own deity and they therefore were not able to go and worship the deity in the temple. So circumstance has some bearing. Okay, well let me ask one, two, they're looking at the young men here. Are there young girls too? Where are they? They're playing. I just want to know, you know, are you guys up for hearing some pastime of Krishna, or we should do it another time? And then having you answer questions about what you saw and heard. I'm not getting a roaring response here. I think I know what that means. Okay. Another time. Okay. Okay. All right. So, let's have some kirtan. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.